Hi, I'm Alex Ward-Booth, and welcome back to Invisible Illnesses, the show that explores hidden health issues and gives practical advice and tips to support those suffering from them, as well as the people around them. Today's episode is our second conversation, or reflection section, with Jill Simpson, an executive coach who's helping us to explore behaviour change, which is an element we've identified from our earlier discussions in the series, conversations with medical professionals and patients telling their stories. If you haven't done so already, I'd really encourage you to listen to at least our first interview with Jill, where she sets out some of the basic principles which we build on in our episode today. If you have listened to that, what we'll be doing today is exploring a few key themes in more detail from those initial discussions. One key element that Steve will be reflecting on with Jill is how her insights from corporate life align with his own medical experience. By seeing the medical and the corporate world alongside each other, I think we get to some new ways of looking at things. Secondly, we'll talk more about the importance of language, how the words we use can be both an indicator and an influencer on how we feel. And finally, we'll talk about the importance of trying to be more reflective on your own behaviour and thinking, stepping outside of yourself, if you like, to find a better perspective. I'm hoping you find today's discussion as helpful as I did. So, first of all, welcome back to the show, Jill. Thank you so much for agreeing to join us again.
Thank you for having me back. It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah, good to see you, Jill.
You too.
In terms of the episode today, one of the reasons we wanted to kind of record a follow-up with the conversation with you, Jill, was that there was just so much in there that we kind of felt we wanted to unpack, and thought, well, probably the best thing we can do is kind of have another catch-up with you, and kind of for Stevie and I just almost kind of play back the sort of big things we took out of our conversation with you, and kind of see if those things kind of resonated with you, and if there's any other kind of additional thoughts that come for that, if that's okay with you.
Sounds great, yeah.
Excellent. So I think kind of the first one to just kind of kick us off with was just really one of the things in terms of listening back to our conversation was kind of almost just underlined why I thought was such a good idea to have you on the show, really, is that I've heard a lot from kind of Stevie and from kind of, medical professionals via him, but how consistent the themes are that are coming out from what you see in terms of exec coaching and what we see in kind of what Stevie sees coming through the door in terms of his patients. And I think that's important in terms of underlying one of the things you said during your call is that, you know, when you're coaching, you coach the whole person. It's not just there's a work you and there's a home you. It's like, but those two things are the same thing. And I think that's quite an interesting thing for us to remember, is these aren't completely different worlds. They are all two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, how we approach our work is the same as how we approach our health and how we approach how we run our lives. We have these sort of ingrained messages in ourselves about how the world should work and how we should work and how to operate within that. And so we tackle problems with a very similar mindset, regardless of, you know, what those problems are. So definitely you have to explore the whole person and think about what drives us, what motivates us, what influences our behaviour, whether we're tackling, as I say, a work problem or a health problem.
We're talking about the human condition, aren't we? And I think one of the things is that it struck me as one of the differences is how it's natural for you in your role to think about things holistically, whereas I feel like we're sort of bucking a trend in medicine to do this to some extent, you know, in that historically medicine set up so that you've got you in your personal world, and then you've got your medical problems, and of course they're you know, completely intertwined, just like everything else is. But I do wonder if there's something about the spectrum of, so having, you know, very powerfully seen that a lot of the factors which we think about to optimize performance in high functioning people and what limits that are very similar factors to what drives illness in people whose functioning is extremely impaired. There's evidence here that this is all part of a spectrum, but I wonder if I was thinking a lot. You got me thinking last time about what the differences are, maybe between some of the patients I see and the clients you see. Or we've talked a lot about some of the similarities, and I wondered if some clues to that might lie in what you see. We talked a lot about stuff that works and how it helps last time, but I suspect you must have clients for whom the recovery is more difficult, or for whatever reasons the obstacles seem too great, or it's difficult to affect change, or and I wondered, you know, we don't like to dwell on the stuff that doesn't go well, but I'd be really curious, because I dwell a lot of time on the stuff that doesn't go very well, to what or who you find things don't go smoothly, and what the obstacles are. Are there any common themes? Are there factors that predict difficulty in moving forward? That kind of thing. Because I wonder if that those situations give us clues to the patients that I'm seeing and what might help them.
Yeah, it's a great question. And everybody transitions through change differently, and some people will find it much harder than others. I think some of the things, certainly in my coaching work, that keep clients stuck can be around the environment they're in, the climate they're operating in, the culture they're operating in the workplace. It's very hard not to want to be like everybody else and to fit in and to belong into that culture. And so if you need to make adjustments, or the way things are done doesn't work for you, it can be very hard to challenge that and try and be different. It's classic with people who maybe overwork and are feeling the overwhelm that might lead to exhaustion. If everybody else is working a 10-hour day, you feel you need to work a 10-hour day. You know, if everybody stays late, you need to stay late. We are so strongly influenced by what is modelled in the workplace. And I think we also have a very, often quite a fixed state about what the world of work should look like. And so we come with all these expectations and conditions and constraints, and it can become very hard to challenge those things and be different to those things. So that's definitely an obstacle, where some people just don't feel they have the permission to challenge the status quo of what the world of work should look like. And so they tinker around the edges trying to make adaptations, but it doesn't fundamentally change anything, because they're still stuck in this working climate or culture that they feel they have to fit into.
And I think there's something really powerful in that. I think you're right, the culture is huge, but also there's certain kind of individuals who see within that culture what they want to see, you know, so that individual, and I know I've been guilty of that myself, of, you know, well, I have to be the one that's working harder than everyone else, because there's that sort of ingrained sense of, you know, I've got to work for this because I, you know, maybe doesn't come so naturally to me, or because I feel guilty about kind of, you know, but perhaps because I've got family and therefore I don't always kind of do long hours, or I can't extend into the weekend, that when I do have those deadlines, I kind of take them much more personally. So I think there's an element of the culture, absolutely. And I think I remember great advice that I received was, you know, if you're in that environment, just get out as quickly as you can. You know, if you feel like that absolutely kind of go get yourself out there. But equally, you do take your own hang-ups with you, and you will contribute to that culture yourself. So there's a little bit of personal reflection, I think, also needs to take place, as well as thinking about the culture.
Totally. You've reminded me, Alex, of it's a non-health related situation, but when I had my son and I returned to work, I was adamant I wanted to go back part-time. But nobody was working, or very few people were working part-time, certainly not at board level roles. And it's sort of, I remember sort of going into those roles and thinking, okay, I'm going to have to leave at 5 o'clock because I've got to get to nursery at 6, and thinking no one else is leaving the office at 5 o'clock. I felt like an absolute outlier. But someone has to go first. Someone has to kind of do it, right? But to your point, it wasn't like I just left at 5 and forgot about work. I would then log on in the evenings to play catch up because I felt I had to. And so I'm still bringing some of my own expectations, standards around work performance and what's expected of me into that. No one at work asked me to do that, but I still felt I had to do that to be a good worker and to contribute well. So it's a whole mix of both the culture, our own expectations, what other people might expect of us. And I think it's same with how we deal with anything. We're influenced by so many different factors. But fundamental to making that stage of my career work, I think, was, as you pointed out, knowing yourself and doing the work on yourself and being very self-aware of your own drivers and obstacles and things that are going to trip you up. I think the greater your self-awareness and you know what your tendencies are, the more chance you've got of kind of making change work for you.
What happens when you think the person who's come, you're seeing as has constraints in their working environment, maybe the attitude of their manager or rigidity about work patterns, that you can see what tweaks need to happen, and maybe they're not someone with the power or the value that you had at board level. How do you advise your clients in that situation? Because you must have met that kind of situation.
Yeah, that comes up a lot, where they don't feel they have either the support of their line manager or the permission from their line manager to make changes. And I think it's tough because we can't always alter some of those external factors around ourselves, but there is always something we can do. I know we spoke last time a bit about the circles of concern and control, right? Yeah. So I can still control some of the choices I make. I may not be able to change my working hours, for example, but I might be able to change how I organise my day within that. I might be able to look after my own energy better than I'm currently doing. I might be able to take more breaks in my day, or I might be able to... I might just need to build up the courage to have a different type of conversation with my line manager. And just because I've asked once doesn't mean there's not some scope here. Maybe I need to approach that conversation differently. Maybe they're under pressure to kind of, and I need to understand their position better. And so it's just about exploring what's possible and not taking that sort of, that constraint as a okay, so I can't do anything and I'm just going to give up. There'll always be something you can do that will improve your situation, even if it's not the big change that you want. Let's look at some small changes and just always kind of say, let's aim for one step towards better. And let's just make one step towards better and see what that gives us. And then we can go again. And there will always be something that you can do to take a step towards better.
Yeah, I love that idea that, you know, I remember reading it in a book. I think it was Atomic Habits. James Clear was talking about, you know, you make a vote for yourself as the person you want to be, and that kind of, it doesn't have to be that, you know, you're trying to get fit, that you're doing, you know, a solid 6 months worth of exercise in one day, because that's never going to happen. But what you can do is go to the gym when it's raining and you don't feel like it, because that is making a vote for the person you want to be. And I always kind of like that. So it's like that, you know, one step towards better is similar vein to that. You know, so there are small things you can do. And I think that kind of brings me to our kind of one thing I wanted to kind of raise to you. Another really big thing that I think came out for the conversation. And I'm smushing a whole load of stuff in here into one point, which I think will probably break out a little bit. But there was a whole theme of suite of things that you talked about in terms of things that would be helpful of, I would just put under the heading of you getting outside of your own head when you're in those situations. And I think there were three key things. One is language, like noticing the language that you use. So you talked about, you know, I should statements. That's a real kind of warning sign. The second one was writing it down. So writing down kind of your perceptions of things and kind of those circles of concern, circles of control, you know, where when you actually write those things down, sometimes it's quite transformational for you. And then the other one was, you know, that kind of perceptual positioning where you talked about imagining advising a friend. You know, those three things feel like really practical things that anyone could do in any situation, be it kind of healthcare related or work related, to kind of spot the own things that are going on. So I wonder if we sort of could work through those a little bit. So I think the one about language, I think, was so telling. And I wonder how much you've seen that, Stevie, when you kind of speak to patients, is that, do you kind of listen out for kind of cues that they're saying and go, aha, yeah, now I'm hearing something and this is sort of, this is showing that there's something else going on below the surface.
Yeah, when it's, I mean, people will say really overt stuff, which belies their drivers that are honourable, have served them well, maybe in other aspects of their life, but are very, very important in why things are not going well now. Be strong and, you know, seeking perfection and just never being able to say no to anybody and taking everything on for everybody, a lack of self-compassion and lots of things they say, I will reflect back to them. And usually it's most productive when I'm explaining a diagnosis, when I'm explaining the illness and what drives it. Because it's very powerful if you can personalize it to somebody, even though these are incredibly common threads that happen with just about everybody that I see with these illnesses. So yeah, often use their language and the specific things they say as very objective things. I think
can you give an example of that? Because that would be quite
they'll often use, so, well, you've just got to push through it, haven't you? Because no one else is going to do it. Or I feel so guilty if, you know, or people will think I'm lazy. It's often couched in what other people think, which I sort of set them. It's the root of lots of these drivers. So there's all sorts of things that they'll say that are very, very, very similar, and just demonstrates the kind of fix or pickle that they're in these situations. I think one of the things that you just said a moment ago, Alex, is that these are things that anyone can do. And I think that really struck me because I have so many patients who feel unable to do any of those things. I have patients who can't walk because of a functional disturbance. There's nothing structurally wrong with their legs, muscles, or neurological system, but they are so weak or tired that they can't. Extremes, I have some that can't, got hospitalized because they can't eat enough, because they feel that they can't swallow or they can't tolerate the intensity of the food in their mouths. It makes them feel sick, and they've got, PEG feeding tubes, which are tubes that go into their stomach because of this. It's extreme medicalization of functional. And these are obviously, in the scheme of things, incredibly, you're one end of a spectrum, and these are not common. And a lot of the time we've talked about, the commonality of functional symptoms in most of us, but there are people at a great extreme, and people who just I find it incredibly difficult to get them to say, look, there are some things that you can do. So I think about actually how your COVI model is essentially, when we see it in paper and read about it, is essentially, like Alex said, something anyone can do. It's a cure-all. You can start from there. But for some people, the block is so great that they're so overwhelmed because it's a single mom with three or four kids, two of whom have got ADHD and autism, and they've got an injunction out against an abusive domestic violent partner who they spotted on their street, and they're having flashbacks, and they're and how do they find the headspace to sit down with a pen? At what point is that more of a priority than getting the food on the table for the kids, Mm-hmm. And there are some people for whom that's the reality of their external world. And for some people, there's a perception of being unable to do this stuff. But I think some of that comes from being unable to sometimes just being unable to let go of the idea of a medical diagnosis, because it's so attractive that if there's some structural disease that can be fixed with an operation or a tablet, and that's what I've kind of believed or expected for the months or years that I've been going to see the doctor, that somebody's given me an explanation which kind of makes sense, but truly the difference between knowing it and believing it and then shifting your mindset to saying, right, I'm going to do some of these things. So letting go of that kind of pre-existing model is, I think, the sticking point for many of my patients who can't move forward. I don't know if you've got any ideas with that, Jill.
Yeah, wow. Not for all of it, and I wish I could solve it, but, we can't. But I think you touched on something really important around us holding on to previous models or ways of thinking about things. Typically we go and see a doctor, we expect a diagnosis, we then have a pathway and we know what to do with that. And when we don't get answers straight away, when we're dealing with so much uncertainty with our own illness and our health, I think it makes things really hard. There is a very useful model I use a lot in my coaching work that talks about how we experience change and how we transition through change. So change is the external event, the thing that happens to us. So we move house, or we have a baby, or we have an illness. And there was work done by an American consultant called William Bridges, and he talks about, in response to any change, we go through three stages of transition. And transition, therefore, is the inner psychological reorientation process we have to go through when faced with any change. Because change inevitably disrupts our status quo, right? We something that is known and familiar and comfortable to us, suddenly, you know, maybe we become ill. And so what we used to be able to do, we now can't do. So change has disrupted that status quo. And Bridges talks about that first stage of endings, which feels a bit paradoxical, because normally we want to rush through the change and get to the new, right? It's like, okay, I'm ill, I want to get better. How do I get better? And we rush to kind of find a solution because we just want this to end. And we do that with anything, whether we're, you know, if we're moving house or whatever, you know, we kind of want to get to the new, right? We want it all to be done, and we kind of rush through the process. But the first stage of any ending psychologically, the first stage of any change psychologically is the ending. And so in the case of our health, I think it becomes about acknowledging what we have to let go of at this particular point in time. So if our symptoms are such that we can't operate in the way we used to operate, we can keep going, oh, I wish it was like it was. I wish I could do my 8-hour day. I wish. There's another language cue there, right? Of harping back to sort of, I wish things hadn't changed and I wish things were like they were, but they're not. And so we have to process the ending in order to be able to move through and start to be positive and proactive about finding something new and good about our situation and find a pathway forward. If we keep wanting what we had, we'll just stay stuck in just building up resentment, being frustrated, being angry, all of those big emotions, because we're not ready or haven't done the work to sort of let go of what was. And it's really hard. Like if you're used to someone, you know, if someone used to being really productive and working a 10-hour day and now you've only got the energy to do 2 hours a day, that's really hard to acknowledge and to say,
I just say that really resonates very, very strongly with stuff I've heard. How do you, it almost sounds like a bit like a kind of a bereavement process, if you like, that you...
It is grieving. Mm. It's loss, right? We lose something. Even with positive change, you know, if you're, I deal with people at work getting promoted or, you know, taking on a new role or changing career, they're positive moves, but you still lose things in that process. So you might lose some peer relationships. Maybe you're now their boss and you were their mate and you've got to readjust and you lose that. Maybe you're going into a role that is quite scary because it's a step up and it's unknown and you've lost that sense of familiarity and feeling like the expert and feeling really confident, and now you're not, and suddenly you're the new person again, whereas before you worked somewhere 10 years and everybody knew you and now you've got to go somewhere new. So there are always some things you have to process that are ending for you, and unless you do that, they tend to kind of resurface a bit further down the line. You know, they'll bubble away under the surface and kind of, so it's trying to, I think, just even recognize what they are. People often just don't spend any time on the ending. So what is it that you have to lose, let go of, grieve in order to move forward?
Are there challenges with the language there? Because what I hear from people, you know, very often hear what you said before, the sort of anger that I can't do this thing or these many things that I used to be able to do, and just so stuck and fixed on that anger and currently not doing anything at all. And so there's something, but you tread a difficult line if you're saying, well, you know, your days of going running are gone, you know, because maybe this is a problem that I have, but I don't want to give them a sense of hopelessness. And I think I've had patients who confuse the idea of acceptance, particularly in the context of acceptance commitment therapy, the idea of acceptance as giving up. Now, this is the way, nothing's ever going to get any better, and that's it. And of course, that's not what you want. You want to say, well, look, we've got to let go of those halcyon days, wherever they were, which probably never quite existed as you're describing them now, anyway. But we've got to let go of those. And we've got to find a new reality. But the new reality is going to be better than the current reality. But I don't know, have you got any linguistic tips? Have you got any phrases or scripts that you use in these situations? I might be putting you on the spot a bit there, Jill. But
yeah, I don't know that I have any scripts in that way. But I think there's a few things that I would work on with a client in that situation. One is notice the emotions and surface them and label them. Mm-hmm. Because emotions are data. emotions aren't something to be avoided. And I think sometimes we either suppress them or, you know, we don't manage them. And I think sometimes let's just name them and understand them, because that calms them in and of itself. That's part of processing the emotions. So let's use our emotions as data and see what that's telling us about our needs and what we might need in this moment. And I think it also relates back when we spoke about the sort of think, feel, do model, the way if we notice our thinking, we can do something about it. And this isn't about, okay, I used to be a marathon runner, I'm going to be a marathon runner again, and we have false hope. But it might be about, okay, if we have the thought, I'm never going to be able to run again, we can adjust that into a more neutral place. So it's about noticing those thoughts and just challenging them gently and going, okay, we might not be able to run a marathon anymore, but what might be possible here? You know, maybe it's, but I can still get outdoors every day and do a lap around the, you know, the neighbourhood or something like that. So I'm going to do that for my outdoor exercise just in the short term whilst we figure this stuff out. So we shift our thinking into something that is more neutral, that is not helpless, nor is it overly hopeful. And we try and find that middle ground of kind of what's possible here in this current moment, accepting what we can't do, but not being defeatist as to saying none of this is ever going to happen again, because we don't know that.
Yeah. Okay, that's really helpful. That's really helpful.
I'm just thinking about the conversation we had with Kieran, actually, when you were talking there, Jill, was that, you know, this was someone who spoke to who was doing kind of ultra marathons and, you know, marathons, and then got ill. And kind of where he is now, you know, the things that he does to sort of stay well and manage his stress, like, you know, he goes swimming every, you know, a couple of times a week, and he, you know, has a choir. And I think if you were to ask him, you know, are those things that you enjoy? Are they things that you bring you joy? He would say yes. You know, and I think he but equally he can look back and go, but equally I enjoyed, you know, climbing a mountain. I enjoyed kind of doing those long runs and those extra. But both those things can be true at the same time. I can enjoy both those things and still be the same person. I think it's when you layer your own identity onto the things that you do and say, I am who I am because I'm working at that level, or because I'm able to do all of those things, or because I'm in that football team, or whatever those things might be. That's when I think there's this sort of gentle challenge of, is that true? And is that, I think I'm just thinking about the phrase you said last time, is that true and is it helpful? Yeah. You know, when you kind of make a note of those things, and I completely get what you're saying, Stevie, earlier about, you know, it's the hierarchy of needs thing. If you're at the point where you're just getting through the day, and I'm not in that world, so I'm not even going to kind of pretend to try and patronise someone who's trying to cope with what you've just described. It sounds absolutely horrendous, and maybe there isn't space for anything else in that situation. But can you take some? Is it going to help for you to take some time for yourself to look at the things, your beliefs you're holding, and go, are those true and are those helpful? And that's probably the writing it down bit, not, you know, trying to make it sound overly fancy or complicated. It's just saying, am I really challenging my own thoughts here? Am I, you know, are there things that I actually, if I let go of that thought, it might help me and be just, you know, as one step towards better, as Jill was saying. So I think that might be an interesting
interesting
perspective.
You know, as I reflect on it, and in the context of, you know, people with, you know, incredibly challenging social situations and the illnesses in those situations, we sometimes talk about a strength-based model of often in the context of mental health presentations and depression and anxiety, and there can be overlap here, and so sometimes, and I think these things would echo what Jill said about, there is still always some window of opportunity. It's often a very small one, but there is some window of opportunity. And so the strengths-based model, also something called solution-focused approaches, where you'll often find where you're in a consultation and all you get is getting is bleak, and you're really struggling to find stuff. But sometimes it's about thinking, well, say you might say something like, well, what was the worst day last week? And they say, oh, Wednesday. And you say, well, what was worse about Wednesday? And they will talk very freely about all the things that were terrible on Wednesday. And we say, well, why was Tuesday better than Wednesday? What was it that was better about Tuesday? And often you then really hit on something, because people will often find it very difficult to explain what was better about Tuesday. But there is something that was better about Tuesday. And in there is the opportunity for something that can be done more of, or something that can be avoided and done less of. So often, and it doesn't feature in a standard medical history very often, which is, tell me what is going well for you at the moment. Tell me what stuff you do enjoy. Tell me what stuff you look forward to. And it's often because it can draw blanks, in people who are, they've got their 10-minute doctor appointment and they are pretty keen to impress on that doctor how bad things are for them at the moment, because they want help and they want things to be different. That's only natural to do that. And they're not expecting to come and talk about what they're good at or what they enjoy or all those kind of things. So you often, it's why the 10-minute, 15-minute GP model has enormous flaws in these situations. If you can get people round to that, then a strengths-based approach can be helpful. But if all they're getting is 15 minutes and then you see them again in 2 weeks or 4 weeks for another 15 minutes and that's it, and then the rest of the time life is exactly as it was, it's very difficult to embed that.
And just kind of, building on that, Steve, I mean, is that some of the work you do in your practice now that is a kind of, as I understand it, a kind of different approach? Is that kind of addressing that? Because I think you're right. I think there's an element that, we are hardwired, I think, to sort of see the negative. It's just a general thing. I mean, it's a survival instinct, surely, is to kind of anticipate all the bad things that are going to happen so that you don't, wander into the, into a saber-toothed tiger without, thinking it's a lovely day, So there's some of that that's hard, but it's also kind of hardwired into the traditional kind of model of healthcare, right? You don't go to the doctor and tell them five things that have gone really well for you that day. That by definition, it's like, tell me what's wrong. So is there some extent to which the work you do, I know you wear lots of hats, this may not be in every sort of every facet of your work, where you are given that more space to explore those things that are going well or try and get to those approaches?
I think it's very difficult in the current NHS environment, particularly in general practice or whatever. We lost 5,000 plus GPs over the last however many years, 10 or 15 years, and it's very difficult. But so our practice is pretty unique in that we have found a way, we managed to get a little bit of additional funding to have this clinic which got sort of four doctors and a physio with an interest in things like chronic pain and functional disorders. And actually the full name of the service is, it's the sort of functional illness, pain and complex lives service. So we're looking at people with very challenging social situations who are consequently presenting very frequently with medical problems, with physical symptoms and illness, and a lot of the time it will be very, we would call pretty standard medical illness, like their diabetes is very poorly controlled, but as of lifestyle factors that come from their social situation that might contribute to that, or they might have a learning disability which makes kind of the dietary stuff much more complicated than for somebody else. So and all these other different factors. So, and one of the key interventions of this clinic, as well as, so the, there's two key interventions. One is having doctors who are interested in this stuff and think holistically about it, and a physio similarly, but the other is time. And so we are offering longer appointments in these clinics to do that. And I work in a big practice team, and the doctors who don't work in these areas, they might look at my clinic and say, well, Steve's only got five patients booked in and I've got 18 booked in, but that, there's no negative. They think, I'm so grateful that I can send my complicated patient to this clinic for them to spend 40 minutes, and therefore I can do something different with my clinic. So doctors see the value of it, patients see the value of it. The problem is changing a kind of health economy in a bigger way, rather than, because what we're doing is, we're spending, however, I mean, it was like we said at the intro episode, really, we're spending billions of pounds of a medical budget on scans and tests and drugs and operations, which don't help people because they're not, the nature of the illness is, that's not the nature of the illness. And that because it changes, it requires such a big paradigm shift in thinking, and doctors are getting it more and more, but that's a filter. And I think, you know, the lay population's increasingly getting it as well. But you also need politicians and strategists and people in the health economy to be able to do that too. And it's a big change. It's a big ask. But yeah, that's quite a digression, isn't it? From
it's very interesting, though, isn't it? And how adopting a different stance or having a model that coexists alongside the current model, but just works better for certain, you know, conditions, challenges that people have in their life. And we sort of force people into a one way of doing things model. And disrupting that is really hard because, as we've said, we don't like change and we don't like the status quo being disrupted. And we're talking about this now on a systemic level as opposed to an individual level. But just how beneficial it can be to give people time and space. All we're doing is, you know, asking good questions, listening really well, you know, finding a pathway through for that individual by understanding that individual and giving them that time and space to explore their situation with an expert who can support them with that. It's not rocket science, you know, but against the system we've got, it feels almost insurmountable, doesn't it, to be able to offer that.
Sometimes.
We're just not set up to have those conversations.
What I would say is that I think the real successes that we have in this clinic are really about getting people on board with an understanding of a holistic and functional illness and moving the majority, not all by any means, but the majority away from this unhelpfully medicalized route. But where we're much less successful, I think, or personally I'm much less successful, is getting people to really feel it, believe it, and change as a result of it. And I think a lot of the stuff I've heard you talk about, Jill, is going to be of very material value to me and to my patients, because whilst nothing you've said has sort of surprised me, it's put it in terms that I can actually much more easily access. Because like you say, it's at one level it's not rocket science, but there is complexity here, and drawing and having these kind of models, you know, whether it's COVID or those bridges things, but having something that I can draw on as a kind of thing, the way the human brain works, is something that I can say, I can apply this now and I can use this. And I think, you know, this is going to, because we doctors are not really, haven't really been trained in this stuff, and I'm doing some training now in GP training schemes, but it's not very core in undergraduate medical training. But so that's been part of our limitation in getting people to change, and I've been very aware of this, that we're, you know, that's a weakness of our training and what I can offer. So taking some of these ideas and from your discipline it is incredibly valuable. I think it's really useful cross-fertilization.
Yeah,
I'm very grateful.
There's so much we can learn from each other, can't we? And let's make these accessible to the listeners. I guess there's lots of very simple frameworks out there and resources we can share that individuals can work on, as well as in partnership with people supporting them. But we don't know what we don't know, right? We don't know what's out there, and sometimes you can just get one or two tools like that I think just can make such a big difference. It's can create real aha moments in people's own self-awareness and therefore their attitude towards an action they can take towards improving their situation.
It ties to Alex's theme a little bit when you talk about getting outside your head, and one way is writing it down and the other way is perceptual positioning, you know, looking at yourself from somebody else's viewpoint. But essentially that's what you're kind of doing as the doctor or as the coach, isn't it? About getting them, you know, reflecting back what that person is saying so that they can hear it, you know, from someone else's mouth. It makes you think about it a bit differently. Sorry,
it's
Alex.
Very interesting. A tool in coaching we use a lot is just playback, which is when someone says something, sometimes you just repeat it in their own words back to them and just say, what does it sound, what's it like to hear that back? And that in and of itself can be massive. You don't actually have to offer anything new, but it's just them noticing their thoughts in a different way, them experiencing themselves through someone else. So it's fascinating how useful that can be as a tool.
Yeah, and I think just sort of stepping back from all of this just for a second and hopefully this kind of comes out right, because I think there's a real hope you can get from this, because I think it's worth reflecting on the fact that some of the stuff you're talking about, Jill, you know, in the world of work, maybe 15, 20 years ago was quite unheard of. You know, I certainly kind of coaching, I think when I started my career, was something that only very, very senior, very, very, you know, only the grown-ups got that. Whereas actually, I think kind of it's something that is very normal now in the world of work to go, actually, I'm having some coaching, I'm having some mentoring, I'm prioritizing my personal development. And I think if we can get to the kind of place where in the world of health, that's normal. You know, actually, I'm kind of talking about how I'm feeling about things as well as how mentally, as well as how I'm feeling physically, and that's helping me to kind of feel better physically. I think that journey is there. It has been trodden, and there's hopefully kind of, as you say, Jill, we can carry on having these conversations over time, and it can become normalised in the same way. But I'm really, really conscious that we've kind of taken up lots of your time again, having already kind of had some of it already, and it's been hugely useful. And as always, I think giving us those kind of practical tips, which, as you say, we'll kind of put into the episode description for anyone who kind of wants to kind of find out more about them. But also just that kind of optimism that, you know, to your point, you know, there is always a kind of step towards better that you can make. So I think that's a very nice note to leave on. So thank you so much again, Jill, for your time. And thanks so much again, Stephen.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you both very much.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jill. It's been great to meet you, and I've really learned a lot, really useful stuff. Thanks very much.
Fantastic. Thanks.
Great. So how did you find that, Steve?
Yeah, it was fascinating, and what an impressive person. I'm slightly conflicted because I've heard new stuff, I've learnt loads, but again, I've got that lovely feeling like there's some themes and things in common. It hasn't sort of pulled the rug out from under me. And again, it's always so remarkable that we end up with these similar concepts and ideas, even though we're coming from completely different professions and different places and different experiences.
Yeah, no, that's great. No, I knew you'd kind of... you'd get a lot out of that those conversations with Jill. And just to say again, a thanks to Jill for her time and recording those two episodes with us. And I think, Steve, I've realised we are now at the end of our first series. So I think
time's
probably
flown, Alex.
We
must be having fun.
Exactly. And I think it's probably worth us doing a bit of a kind of an overall, you know, reflection on kind of what we've learned over those eight episodes. And I think kind of, you know, it was interesting because Jill ended on a note of optimism. And I think that's kind of one of the things that I would, you know, say has come through from all of the episodes, is that actually there is this kind of sense from all of our guests that, you know, this is a functional illness is a hard topic. It's really difficult and it's complex. And we haven't always, as a society, as a kind of medical profession, perhaps understood it fully. But it does feel like we're going in the right direction. It does feel like there's a lot of positivity on it. So I wanted to kind of just, I guess, put you on the spot a little bit and say, you know, thinking about those sorts of final episodes, what have you taken out of it, and what have been your learnings from it? So yeah, I don't know if you've got anything that kind of springs to mind from your side.
Well, I mean, it's been great, and I spend an awful lot of time running these ideas and new thoughts around my head, and I do frequently talk to colleagues as well about these issues, but often in short bursts, and their experiences are kind of necessarily similar to mine. We're coming from the same kind of place, so to dedicate this much time to hearing from other people, especially those coming to this from a different place, either professionally like Jill or experientially like you and Kieran, you know, has been a wonderful and enlightening experience. And I've learned new concepts, new ways of thinking about similar concepts. I've learned new phrases. Like I said at the start, I'm struck again by the similarity of some of the conclusions, even though we're all coming from different places. And I think that gives me a great sense of security that we are on the right track. I just really hope that in some small way, you know, people might have found this interesting, possibly, hopefully surprising in places, but maybe even learned some new ways to understand, you know, their experiences or experiences of people close to them or around them. Because I think, you know, the wider the understanding we have the more successful we're all going to be at navigating what are the elements of kind of the human condition, really. Power is, you know, knowledge is power and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Knowledge is power. I think that's a really nice note to end on, because, I think my personal experience has been, you know, once you hear these concepts and you talk about this stuff, you start to see it everywhere, both in your own life and in those of people around you. And I think, you know, knowing this stuff can help you to kind of almost stop yourself when you're maybe going down a certain pathway and see, are there different things I can do, different ways I can look at this situation to maybe get to a better or a different outcome than, you know, one perhaps you've been stuck in and having those cycles. But it's been really great, and I really appreciate your time over the last eight episodes to kind of helping pull this together, and I really appreciate it, and I hope those of you listening have enjoyed it, and do let us know, and you know, we may be back for a second series at some point depending on our availability, but in the meantime, thanks everyone for listening, and thanks for your time.
Great, thanks Alex. We'll be right back.